Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. Tavis Not-So-Smiley, a.k.a. Captain Anadonia, and welcome to a lavish edition of Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know, because I need some excitement in my life. And today I got an old colleague of mine, back in the News and Observer days. She used to copy edit a lot of my stuff, and I'm sure she has a lot of wonderful stories about dealing with me as a co-worker and colleague. So Pamela Blackburn Nelson, friends call her Pam, welcome to the Krizzlecast, ma'am.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's nice to have you and see you down there in Clayton. Is it Clayton? Yep, up in Clayton.
Yep, that's where I live. Yeah. Out in the country.
How long have you lived in Clayton?
Let's see, we moved here in 1995.
95, wow. Because we used to work almost right next to each other in the News and Observer office, and then there was that nice point where you had to go to Charlotte in order to do what you did in Raleigh.
That's right. Yeah, the company we work for, the McClatchy Company, started laying off people. And then they decided to move the copy desk to Charlotte and create a regional copy editing production center. And they told us that we could have jobs there, those of us who were copy editors and page designers, or we could take the buyout and leave the company. And I decided to go work in Charlotte because my parents lived not too far from there, and I thought I could live with them and commute to Charlotte and then come home on the weekends. And that lasted for 7.5 months before I got a job in Durham. So I was able to come back home and live in my house with my husband. So that was good.
It was just a hassle for 7.5 months going back and forth. And
yeah, it was. And, you know, working in the production center wasn't that bad because I was around people I knew because we'd already been working with the people in Charlotte for, you know, months beforehand, just at long distance. So people who don't know, Charlotte is about 180 miles from Raleigh, where our office was in Raleigh and Charlotte's 180 miles away. And I also worked for the News Observer at the time when the Charlotte Observer was our enemy, you know, with our rival.
Yeah.
And then the McClatchy Company bought what used to be Knight Ritter. So then Charlotte was all of a sudden our sister paper.
Yeah.
But anyway, the people at the production center were nice, and I was still, you know, doing the same thing, editing the same copy, only 180 miles away, working with the same editors and, well, some of the same writers at least. There were many of you all had been laid off or had left, but the people who were there I still work with them, and I think I helped the transition, you know, help bring the transition, but it was really a hassle. And it was nice being with my parents though. My parents are both in their 80s, so it was nice being around them. So that was good.
How long they've been together now?
My parents have been married since 1951, so that's almost 62 years.
Wow, isn't
that amazing?
Yeah, it is quite amazing. Like, what would you say is their secret? What is this, like, they still throw down or something?
Secret, yeah, well, their secret is that they're, you know, really strong Christian faith, and they also just, you know, they grew up in a time when people in our neck of the woods, anyway, didn't get divorced. And didn't, you know, and my mother's also been very tolerant of some of my father's. I will say that my mother is probably compromised more than my father in that relationship, you know, but I mean that in a really good way, because I think my father is just a really strong personality. He wants what he wants when he wants it. And my mother is someone who is more of a nose to the grindstone, you know, stick it out kind of thing. And she worked, she was a teacher for 40 years. And then after she retired from teaching, she went to the school board in her county. So, and she was on the school board for, I don't remember how long, 16 or 18 years. And she just retired from that just a couple of years ago because my father's health got so bad. She couldn't really take care of him and do the school board at the same time. So yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's what it is. I think it's, you know, to me, that's kind of a secret of good relationships anyway, is that somebody has to compromise sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes one person will do more than the other.
Yeah.
And I, you know, in my marriage, it's more, we both of us compromise and, you know, I know what's important to him. So I let him be the leader in that part. And he knows what's important to me. So I'm the leader in the part that's really important to me. Like we're remodeling our bathroom, okay. Our master bathroom. And we kind of agreed on what we wanted, but a lot of the things have been, you know, I said, okay, I want this kind of tile and I want this, you know, these colors and all that kind of stuff. And he went along with it. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't really want to get off on marriage, but marriage is important. It's a good thing. Good marriages are really, the older I get, the more I appreciate the fact that I have a husband who I'm really compatible with. Somebody who's just has a sense of humor that I just adore and who's very witty and smart. And I like that. I hope you find that someday.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. That I'm still single and lonely. Yes.
Sorry.
Robin, you're long. Robin, not only your long union in my face, but your parents' long union. They'll just like
get. Well, when you do.
What?
When you do get married, it'll last a long time. I know
it. I'm sure it won't. But how long y'all been together?
My husband and I have been married since 1987, so that means 25. Yeah, we were 25 years last October.
25, you know, doing the mm-hmm. whole silver thing, and
yeah.
So how did y'all hook up? When did that happen?
We worked together at the newspaper in Fayetteville, mm-hmm. North Carolina. I went there as a copy editor, and he was a reporter who also did some copy editing on the weekends, and. The first time I saw him, I thought, boy, he is so cute. But he was younger than me. I mean, he continues to be younger than I am. But anyway, he and I just became friends and then we decided to become more than friends. So that was great. I was really happy about that.
How young are we talking about here?
He's 5.5 years younger than I am.
Wow. So yeah, you were just. You were the MILF in this situation, I see.
Yeah, I guess so. I was.
Getting your cougar on in this.
Yeah, I was kind of a cougar when it came to Chris. Yeah, I was. But it was, I was kind of, maybe I was an immature 32-year-old. I don't know, 30, however old I was. Anyway, I was older when I got married too. So that was a kind of, I don't know, I think that, I didn't ever expect to get married. I really didn't. I thought I would be an old maid. I really did. And so it was kind of interesting when Chris and I got together because he proposed. He was the one who brought up marriage first. And I still think that it was just kind of wonderful fate that I ended up in Fayetteville when I met him.
I mean, how were you and got married?
I was. Okay, we got married in 87, so I was 33. I was 33 when we got married, yeah. So I'm almost 60 now. I'm 59 years old.
59 years old. So I guess, like, back then you were still rocking the Annette Bening haircut, I remember.
Yeah, I think so.
I saw a picture of you once that you were much younger and you had the Annette Bening cut going on.
Yeah, I think so, right. Yeah, I was a lot. I had just lost a bunch of weight then. Then when I turned 30, I was really heavy. And then when I turned 30, I lost a bunch of weight, and I was like almost petite. Not, you know, I didn't really consider myself skinny, although other people told me I was. But anyway, I was a lot smaller than I am right now, and a lot smaller than I was before or since. So, I was very I was actually kind of emaciated looking, apparently. I don't know. Anyway, I didn't think I was, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know whether I had to met Benny. Yeah, I guess I did, sort of. It was in the 80s, so yeah, we had big hair in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes, I remember it well.
Yeah, just a little kid, yeah.
Hey, you know, y'all still have that ex that grinds me about how young I was, and I would bring up how young I was when stuff happened in pieces. I remember I did a review of the Greatest American Hero came out on DVD, and I remember I wrote how I used to watch that when I was four, and basically half the copy desk was just like, "You were four when this came." I was in high school smoking cigarettes and just like. We can go into that. Just basically, was that probably one of the reasons why I always felt animosity towards most people over there, apart from the fact that
I don't know whether that was. I mean, I think there probably is some kind of animosity, like from people who are old, because we used to be the Wonder Kings, you know, those of us who, you know, when I was in my 20s. And I was working in newsrooms, and I was really good and smart at my work, you know, really good. And I was the Wonder King. And then before I knew it, I wasn't anymore. I was like the mom. And then there was somebody like you who you're just so good at what you did. I mean, really, you know, even you were always really good. You are always really good at what you do. And it was kind of cool though. And it was also amazing because you're such a fount of information about pop culture, you know, it is amazing how much you know, and it really informed your writing, I thought. It made your movie reviews even better because you knew so much about movies and about pop culture and about a segment of pop culture, and this is that was completely alien to me, you know, because I don't know anything about hip hop. I don't know anything about and all those shows that you watched growing up, the TV that you watched growing up. I was doing other things or something, and I don't know anything about it. And it was, you know, that was one of the good things about being a copy editor on your copy, because I would learn new things, you know, like learn new words and learn new things about the world, and reading you writing about music, especially, even though you didn't write as much about music as you wrote about movies. But when you did write about music, it was kind of interesting. I would have to look up references because I didn't really understand, you know, I didn't really know them, but I knew that the people who cared about it would know it, you know, and I always trusted that you were correct on these things and correct in your, correct in your assertions, I guess I should say. But I didn't have anything to go by. So that was good. So that's why newsrooms should be like that. Newsrooms should be old goats and young goats. And, you know, and there should be lots of people from lots of different backgrounds. People who grew up rich, people who grew up middle class, people who grew up poor, people who grew up white, people who grew up black, you know, whatever, to make it so that it makes it a better newspaper. It makes it a better organization, not just newspapers. It makes it a better organization everywhere if there are a lot of different kinds of people. And I know that sounds like I'm just spouting off liberal, you know, pap, but it really is true. I really deeply believe that, you know, that it's a good thing.
Well, were there any amazing discoveries during our time together that
well, you know, the word sadity.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was a little one, but, you know, it was like one of those things where you would use words and I didn't really know what they meant, you know, and so I would turn to your editor who was, well, Adrian, or before that, Amber, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Adrian Johnson and then Amber Nimmark. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another thing about being a copy editor. Sometimes you get so, hidebound, like, okay, this has to be this way. Mm. And we can't use the word sadity because if I don't know it, then most of our readers won't know it.
Yeah.
But then I realized well, shoot, you know, they can understand it in context, for one thing.
Yeah.
And for another, I'm not sure that our readers who were my age were the audience for your reviews. You know, I thought that your reviews appealed to a different group, and that a lot of our older readers would probably, shoot, they don't go to the movies anyway. You know, I mean, they stay home anyway. So to me, that's why your voice was really important too. You know, I'm going to have trouble pinpointing exactly one thing that I learned from reading you, but one thing that I did get from editing you and from reading you is that kind of viewpoint that's really strong. And even though you didn't, I know that you weren't self-assured. I know that you had massive anxieties about things, but I think that you were assured in what you knew, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
and what you knew about movies and what you felt about movies. And you were writing about movies, not just what you thought, but also how it made you feel too. And I don't know. I just think your voice was one of those things that made the sections that we both worked on different too, you know? It was like David Menconi, who we both, our colleague at the NNO, who's a wonderful writer and a really good reporter and, you know, and a wonderful, his really strong writing was another one of those things that made our sections really good, I think, you know? Anyway, and all the writers, we were blessed with some really good, strong reporters and writers, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, and that was to me one of the interesting things of being a part of that whole, the department at the time, because it was a department. It was a bunch of writers and editors putting together.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of great copy editors as well, along with you and I can guess back with Deborah Boyette, who, you know, she was a copy editor before she became the features editor, and Neil Amato, Dean Smith, Chuck Small. Matter of fact, one of the reasons I got you to do this, if I asked you if you wanted to do this, was because a week ago I was on Facebook and I saw that Chuck put something on his timeline, how he was reading the NNO, and apparently he's reading a headline and somebody used the word illicit, E-L-I-C-I-T, but there was actually supposed to be illicit, L-I-I-I-C-I-T, and it drove him batty, and of course a lot of the former copy editors chimed in and everything like that. And I don't know if that's something you still do, read the NNO to get pissed off, as Chuck does apparently.
Yeah, I do. I mean, just today I picked up the paper to read, and the very first story I picked up to read had a grammar error in it, and it was lay and lie, so, which is easy to mess up. But it was still like, oh, I just, you know, wish I were there so I could fix that. And then I read something else where there was a little copy editing thing that I could have fixed if I'd been there.
Yeah.
You know, and it was in the entertainment section that we used to work on. But yeah, it's funny because you do kind of, you don't ever give that up. And then, you know, I still look at the paper because it is a really good paper. I mean, even though the first story I read had a grammatical error, I didn't stop reading the paper. I mean, I kept reading it because there's all kinds of good stuff in it. The stories, you know, about the crime for one thing, and then just the politics. North Carolina politics is so awful. So, you know, the NNO continues to do a really good job with that. And I read the Iron Man review.
Did Topman do that?
Yeah, Topman did that. He started out with something that was kind of off point, but anyway, it turned out okay.
well, what I was saying is that just like, you know, there were a lot of great copy editors there and also a lot of great people there, and it was a department, and as the years progressed and layoffs started happening, and people had to move to Charlotte.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's basically just doesn't exist. Fee's apartment.
Right.
I believe it's just Adrian and Menconi, and that's pretty much it these days. I was there like not too long ago, and I was talking with Craig Jarvis, who used to edit my stuff on Sundays, and he just talking about there's nobody here. It's depressing.
I know. It's really sad.
Yeah. I left before you. They kicked me out the door before you decided to go on your way.
Yeah.
So, how was it those last few months when after the guy split and just, like...
Well, that was a problem because the fact that they laid you off maybe made us mad. You know, it really irritated me and Adrian personally because we both liked you a lot. But, you know, from her point of view also, she lost a writer. She didn't have any more firepower.
Yeah.
You know, she kept losing firepower to fill her section with. And it was, you know, I thought it was really terrible. So we had to start using, you know, well, we started using the Charlotte writers, which, you know, it's okay, I guess. But the whole last few years in the newsroom were kind of sad because I've been there at the when things were really great, like we had a full staff, you know, you were there and you know, the whole features department was just chock full of talent.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole newsroom was chock full of talent. And I've been there during the really boom times before McClatchy bought the paper.
Yeah.
When we had lots of money and we were, you know, doing the best at doing really good jobs. And I'd worked with a lot of really people who were too good for the market, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because Raleigh is such a good place to live and the newspaper was so good that we got a lot of people there who would really have been working in Washington or New York or Chicago or someplace.
Yeah.
But they stayed because we had a good paper and we had a good situation and they could, you know, they could live a decent life in Raleigh or Cary or wherever. And now, I don't know, I don't recognize all the names in the paper anymore because of course they've hired, you know, new younger people for positions. I presume new younger people, you know, I'm letting go. I'm pretty good at, it's been a whole year now since I left the publishing center, so I'm feeling pretty detached from it, you know, most of the time. Except for when I read something, I think, oh, well, I would have edited that differently, or I think they missed the boat on something. But, you know, most of the time I'm busy doing other things, so it really, you know, it doesn't gnaw at me as much. But anyway, but I was really irritated when they laid you off because I thought that was such a bad decision because you were a unique voice and a unique talent that they really should have kept. You know, that was my opinion.
Well, you know, well, first off, thank you. And secondly, you know, kind of, I can't even fault you, you know, because they let me in there 7 years and you know as well as anybody, I did a lot of things that merited dismissal.
Uh-huh.
And so the fact that they kept me so long, like I was shocked. I was sure I would have been like when they really started doing the whole layoffs back in 2008. I thought, oh well, I guess I better go now, and better start and everything. But they kept me around for a few more years, and just like so, they gave me a job for 7 years. I can't even fault them, you know. Just now they,
that is good.
You know, they held me for as long as they could. Despite everybody complaining.
Right, yeah, I know. I mean, I know, but they were, you know, that was smart on their part, I thought. You know,
yeah.
It was smart of the writers, I mean, of the editors who were, you know, who spoke up and said, no, he's, you know, he's I'm presuming. See, I wasn't privy to what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, I really was oblivious to a lot of the politics that happened at the NNO. I know that sounds weird. I was oblivious to the politics. I was oblivious to the gossip. I mean, yeah. People would all of a sudden get married to each other, and I never even knew they were dating, you know. So I was just oblivious to a lot of things.
Yeah, just well.
Some of it was I'm not that outgoing a person, so it's, you know, I don't do a whole lot of gossip about, not that I don't like it, I love gossip, but,
yeah.
You know, I don't always do it.
Well, it just basically made you a person with a life. You had things to do apart it was very eye-opening to hear always secondhand about how, you know, somebody didn't like me for whatever reason, or just didn't like what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
I'm just like, well, if you don't like what I'm doing, you can always talk to me about it, or you don't have to, you know, complain to an editor or go to HR or whatever that you want. You know, and it kind of showed me how, you know, because I thought, like, when you grew up and became an adult, you had, you know, you took responsibility for whatever you did. And I found that even when you're at that age where you should know better and you have responsibility, it's like there's still a lot of cowardice going on. And it's disheartening as hell to know that there are adults that I work with who are just basically, you have nothing else to do but to snitch on me and rat me out or whatever. They just because they out for whatever data they have, they just don't think I'm a good beacon of whatever. I'm not a good representation of what the NNO is supposed to be or whatever.
Yeah. I know. I never understood that whole snitching to HR about stuff. I mean, unless somebody is just, I don't know. I mean, unless it's a really bad situation where you are personally bothered. I mean, you know, like if somebody were personally harassing me and, or say if my boss were personally harassing me, and then I would have to go to HR. But just to tattle on people, on the copy desk for a while, we had this thing where they said, this was when I was on the news copy desk before I came in the feature, so it was years ago. We had the dress code thing, you know, where it was not, and so guys would show up on the copy desk dressed in really inappropriate stuff, you know, for the under the dress code.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just decided that it wasn't my job to enforce the dress code. It wasn't my job to go either to say something to them because they were working their butts off till 1 a.m. I wasn't going to say anything to them. And for another thing, to tattle on them, you know? I mean, it's something, if they were really important, if I saw somebody doing something really unethical, you know, I don't know what I would have done because I don't like confrontation very much, but I doubt if I would have gone to HR about it because it just seems like that's like Russian informants, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting you say you don't like confrontation because there was only one time you ever confronted me about anything, and that was when there was this meeting between the feature department and I think it was Melanie's. Phil, who was, the editor right there, and there was a huge discussion about how, you know, we gotta talk down, we gotta be a lot more, fundamental with the, you know, writing and everything, the stories, and I think I was there for about a year, and I was just like, I know what got into me when I just said, like, is this, like, why, like, I was doing this whole big thing about how just, you know, why are we talking down to our readers? I mean, are we talking down to, have we been talking down to our readers? And, like, should we be more attentive to our, to our readers' intellect and giving them more things to write about, anything like that. Just like, I don't know if we've been doing this so far beginning, but like, you know, we shouldn't have to be like that just for daily paper. And I think when we all got back up to the feature department, I mean, you talked to me about you rolled up to me about how just like, just be, you know, because like I was making the argument that, you know, that we, you know, if we have been doing that, you know, we shouldn't do it. And I think you took umbrage with the assumption that I thought that we've been doing that so far.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so I think it was more like I think you might have been upset at the fact that you thought that I was assuming that, like I said, I was new, so I was assuming that y'all were just dumbing down the paper and everything.
Yeah. It's funny, I don't remember. I don't remember. That's really bad. I feel bad that I don't remember. But yeah, it sounds like something I would have taken umbrage with. If I thought that you were saying that we were dumbing down the paper,
yeah,
then I would find that offensive. You know, but that wasn't what you were saying anyway, right? So
you were saying,
are we doing this?
Yeah.
Is that with a meeting with Melanie?
Yeah, I know. I was either meeting with Melanie or Linda Williams,
Melanie
or something
Sill,
like that.
We should identify Melanie Sill was the executive editor of the paper.
Yeah.
Of people who might be listening to this podcast who don't know all the characters.
Yeah.
Like our Uber boss.
Yeah, she, who I famously complimented in a dress and told her to twirl around for me.
And she did.
Yeah, she did. And apparently, it was so funny because it became the talk of the building.
I can see why.
That was another thing. Like they people would ask me, "How did you get Melanie Sill to twirl around?" I asked her, "Can you twirl?" It was like a Friday afternoon. Nobody was around. We were all bored. We weren't doing anything. She came down to the features department, and she was wearing this nice, colorful dress and whatever. And I said, "Hey, you're looking good. You know, want to twirl around for me? Mind twirl around?" And she twirled around, and then just like everybody, like, "Did you hear what Craig said?" And it's just, oh man, that's how it begins, like you said, people just have these assumptions or misunderstandings, the next thing you know, it becomes this huge thing that blows up, and then it's one of many urban legends about me that go on in the Carolina publishing world.
Oh, that's funny. I never knew about that story. See, I told you, I didn't hear gossip. I didn't, you know, people would not tell me stuff. Yeah.
But it was, I got along fine with the copy editors. I think y'all were bust.
Yeah, as long as you get your copy into us on time, that was the only thing that was ever annoying is with you and not just you, but other edit writers who would be late.
As you mentioned earlier, I had such anxieties about myself. I would write it. I would spend hours writing it, and then I would turn it into you, and then I would be sitting at my desk fretting about what the hell I just wrote, and then I would just go back and forth over to the copy desk, and just like you know, go over your shoulder. I understood it was like a very annoying process. You guys were just trying to bring it out because I didn't want to not just make myself look bad, but make the section and the part look bad. I really wanted. Like, I really took pride in my work because y'all were paying me and gave me health benefits.
Right.
I mean, sometimes it's like the pressure be too much. I never forget this one time I just lost it on Deborah. She had me as your copy. And I don't know, I just flipped out. Like, what? You guys are trying to just, and just like, it was, you know, it was like still one of those moments I'm very ashamed of. I know if you were there, but I had to apologize because it was just this crazy freak out moment. It didn't even make sense. It's just like I was speaking in tongues because I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Really, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was, it's the truth. I mean, it's just like, it was just this weird moment. And so, but y'all were cool. And, you know, like I said, you just fit. But it was like, it was funny because I think it was mostly the page designers who, you know, for some reason, you know, they were an ominous dark bunch. And apparently, if you cross them.
Yeah, like, you didn't want to mess with the page designers. That's true. I mean, the thing is that they felt disrespected by people being late with their copy because they were like saying, you know, you don't need time to the page designers. You don't need time to do your work. You know, we're gonna push it right up to the last minute because the writing is so much more important than what you're doing. I mean, that's the way they saw it. I'm not saying that that's the way the writers saw it, but that's the way they perceived it. And I perceived it that way sometimes too as a copy editor. It's like, well, crap, you've had all day with this and I get, you know, 15 minutes. That's not fair. And so that's why it would irritate me, you know, sometimes. But at the same time, by the time you knew me in that point in my career, I had realized that it wasn't about me. No, none of this was about me. This was about the paper getting out and getting into people's houses and being as accurate and as well written as possible. And if the reporter needed to come over to me three times and tell me, oh, be sure you fix this. I meant to say something there. That was worth it because it would be right. And so it was kind of a maturity thing, you know.
Yeah.
If you'd known me 15 years earlier, I probably would have been a much less patient person. Mm. If you'd known me 20 years ago, I probably would have been even less patient. But maturity kind of comes on you after a while, whether you want it to or not.
Yeah.
And so, but I did understand that. And that's what people in any job that they're ever in, you know, if you're a waiter or if you're on the wait staff somewhere, it's not about you. It's about the customer.
Yeah.
If you're in a work for a publication, it's not about you. It's about the reader.
Mm.
And so don't get all bent out of shape about something just because it's not exactly what you want.
Yeah.
You know, and I did understand the anxiety of writers because it has your name on it. It's something people from you. And I knew that it was absolutely important for writers sometimes to fiddle with stuff.
Yeah. Because people, so, well, first off, is your earbuds, is your earbud cord over your left arm or under it?
It's on top.
Okay. Well, yeah. Cause it keeps on, I keep on hearing it just like click clatter and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. I keep my arms out of the way. Maybe
that's
I need
right.
to
yeah.
keep.
I just remind you, just sorry for that pause. But yeah, cause, you know, like people still have this sense that, you know, not to say you guys are important, but they don't necessarily know about the copy editors. They don't just necessarily know about, the page design. They don't necessarily know about the editors in general. They just know the byline, just who's writing it. And, and so they just assume that everything that you're involved with, everything that happened with that piece, so they don't take accountability. That is a team of people that gets all this stuff out there, and so it was I'm glad you understand the anxiety that I was coming from because they're the ones that call me. The readers are the one that called me. The readers are the one that email me. And say, hey, you get that right. You get that word right. Where, and just, you're an idiot. And so. As I've talked.
See that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing worse than a person in a southern accent calling you up and telling you to do your research. It's just, do your research. It's just, it's is soul crushing. But you know, you were, I think you were, and I hate to play favorites, but if you want to talk about a copy editor, I had not the most open relationship with, well, just the most fun, because let's face it, you had treats. And
that's true.
Yeah, you would have various different, you first started with, Quaker oatmeal bars.
Yes.
That you would have in your drawer, and then it graduated up to Nutri-Grain bars. It just became this running thing where it just like, Pam has treats in her drawers.
That's right.
And
I was glad. See, I think that's important anyway for people to have treats, you know, but,
yeah.
But especially I knew that you would need a snack at some point. So I was glad to have that, especially since I knew you liked those oatmeal bars. So I would buy them. My husband and I would go to the grocery store and I would think, okay, Craig likes those, so I'll get those. And it was like, Chris would say, oh, it's like he's your kid or something, you know? I said, well, yeah, a little bit, you know, a little bit like that. But yeah, I thought I got you. I thought I understood you, you know? I understood that you had, that even though you were really good and that you knew a lot of stuff, that you had a lot of anxiety and that, and especially social interactions. Mm-hmm. Are a little bit problematic because I have a little bit of that too. I have a little bit of social anxiety also, so I understood. And my son was like that too, so it was easier for me to understand that sort of thing.
Yeah, and there's times when I felt so bad because I would just go to your desk just to get treats, and it got to the point where I actually started buying them, and just like if you ran out, I would go to Sam's or something.
Yeah,
and get you.
Thank you.
And get you a box and just feel just for all the times I snarf down your treats. But,
that was good.
Yes, and but this, how, it just makes me, ask, like, because I don't think I've exactly gotten to how long you've been doing the copywriting thing. Like, how do you even get to the point where this was the common thing? Like, because it's gone all the way back to when you first got married, so. How did it begin for you
I get into being happy?
Yeah.
I graduated from college in 1976, and I went to work for the Hickory Daily Record in North Carolina as a features writer there. Uh-huh. But we also did desk work, and it turned out that I really liked the desk work a lot more than the writing, because
uh-huh.
I really don't like to talk to strangers that much. So, then there was an opening on the desk, and I took it, and that was it. So after that, I was pretty much a copy editor. Sometimes I was a supervisor of copy editors, and I was the managing editor of a website for a while. But so that's almost, how long is that? 38 years, almost 37 years, maybe. Yeah. That I've been a copy editor, and I really, it suits me because it's sort of, you know, I like grammar a lot. I write a blog about grammar and about copy editing, really. And I like writing headlines a lot. I don't get to write headlines as much as I used to, but I like writing headlines, and I like the do it one day and get it and it's done. You know, like with writing, you're going to have things that work on for several days or even a week, or, you know, with investigative work, you write, you know, you work on it for months. And I come in that day, that shift is putting out the paper, and then next day I put out another paper, and next day I put out another paper, and I really like that part of it. And then, of course, after I did get married and I came to work at the NNO, or let's see, I came to work at the NNO and then I got married later, a few months later. And then we decided to have a child. So working at night on the copy desk meant that I could stay home with my child during the daytime. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to, you know, take him to, he had like a sitter for a while between the time I left for work and my husband got home from work. And, so that worked out. So that, you know, from just a lifestyle point of view, it worked out to work at nighttime. So that was good. Of course I was tired a lot, and I don't recommend it for anybody. I have a friend who's a Facebook friend who just had wife just had a baby, and he works at night on a copy desk, and he's so tired, and I know exactly what he's going to, and I think I just feel for him. I wish I could you know, do something, but there's nothing else you can do. You know, you have to take care of the baby and you have to do your job. So it's hard. It's a hard life. Anyway, that's how I became a copy editor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where did you go to college?
I went to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, which used to be the women's college of the University of North Carolina, but in 1964 it became co-ed. So by the time I got there in 72, it was fully co-ed, although there were more women there than men. And I majored in English.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite course in college was the grammar course that I took, which was the very best. And the second favorite course was an anthropology course in linguistics, which was really good. But anyway.
So yeah. Okay. So you went to a college that was formerly a woman's college, then became co-ed in the 70s. So you went to college that, right. So basically, yeah, I'm guessing a lot of wacky shit went on during that time.
Yeah, yeah, we did. We, you know, it was the 70s, so there was a lot of, a lot of drugs and a lot of people hooking up, I guess is what you young folks call it. And it was fun. I loved the 70s. I mean, people used to ridicule the music. But they're thinking about disco, you know, and disco did suck. But before that, you know, there was the Eagles, which maybe people think that sucks too. But, you know, there was a lot of really good music in the 70s, and there were a lot of good drugs, and there were, you know, a lot of friendliness among boys and girls. So it was good. Well,
Did you partake in any of that stuff, the drugs and the...
Well, you know, not too much because I was mostly too scared to buy illegal drugs, you know. So I smoked a little pot and I drank and that's about it. I never did anything harder than that. I never did anything. And so it's funny because I knew people who did, although it wasn't that much, like there was in the 70s, there wasn't that much cocaine. There were some people who did, speed, amphetamines, I guess.
Yeah.
But not too much of that. And I guess there were some people who did heroin, but I never knew any of them. But it was mostly, you know, pot and alcohol and a lot of drinking,
yeah.
You know.
What about the friendliness part? What about the...
Well, the friendliness was good, yeah. I don't want to talk too much about that. But anyway, yeah. I was not a big party girl because I just was kind of shy and didn't do that a lot, but I did enjoy watching the parties going on and stuff. So I had one sort of kind of boyfriend senior year, but that was about it. I thought he was nice anyway. But then I graduated and I never saw him again, I don't think. I don't think I ever did. Yeah.
I love how you downplay it. Just like you weren't a party girl, but you liked watching the party. So there's a lot of freaky shit going on. You just like to watch and everything. Just
no, it wasn't that. It was just watching people connect, you know. And I don't mean take their clothes off and have sex. I mean people flirt and kind of start to. And you have to understand how. You've never been a 20-year-old girl, but 20-year-old girls really like to talk to their friends about their relationships, you know? So I would have friends who were, like, having sex with more than one person. I only knew a few gay people, but anyway, or a few people who were out at the time. But anyway, I had friends who were getting to be friends and getting to, you know, have relationships with boys, and they would come back and tell me about it, and it was interesting, you know, it really was. I liked to listen to what they were saying, and I liked to sit at parties and watch people flirt with each other. It was fun, and think, oh, they're going to do it, you know, and I don't know whether they did or not, but I would think, oh, I bet they're going to do it. And I even had a boyfriend, a friend who was a boy, who would tell me about his relationships with girls. And I loved it. I loved hearing about it because it was interesting to me to hear it from a boy's point of view. And I do talk about boys because we were really young. I mean, we were 20, 21 years old, and that's really young, you know. Anyway. But, yeah, the 70s were a lot of fun. I think it was a good time. And, even though I didn't do a whole lot of wild partying, I did enough so I don't have to feel, you know, like I missed it or anything. I did see it. But, yeah, you're right about being in a situation where there are lots of girls and not as many guys, and how it was different. And a lot of the guys I found out much later were probably not interested in girls. It didn't occur to me as much then. Yeah.
Thank God I'm on antidepressants, or this whole this whole chunk of the conversation would have sent me over the edge, because I didn't have any of that shit. And it's funny when you talk about how, you know, you talk with girls and just talk about their experiences and you found it to be interesting. And then that's what I found to be different. Like, girls will get together and talk about all this stuff. And guys, you know, I can only speak for myself, but when, you know, there are times like I was just talking to this with a friend of mine a few weeks ago, where he was talking about how he had a one night stand, and I was just like, there's a part of me like, I don't want to hear this shit. Lay down. Because you can take that shit and shove up your ass. I'm not getting it. I'm not getting a goddamn thing. So don't try to, you know, don't bard me with your luckiness, you son of a bitch, and all that stuff. So just like, we're very bitter like that, or at least I'm very bitter like that. But it's nice to know that you had fun in the 70s, as I'm sure everybody in the 70s had fun. I was born in 76, so unfortunately I grew up in the era of AIDS and black women who weren't giving up anything. So it's just, I'm just fucked all the way around. And I don't know why I'm putting this on you, but I'm just letting you know how I roll. So this.
I'm sorry. But it was, you know, I'm sorry that you were born too late there.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you were born exactly the right time. You were born at the right time.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
76, you know, when I was in high school. Now, for some reason, you know, it was, I don't know. It's just like.
So how was high school for you? Was high school sucky? Did you hate high school? Or?
It's funny because, like, the first 2 years were cool. Like, I still had hope or whatever. Like, I just realized, hey, I'm kind of beginning to know my place in the world. And then the last 2 years, when you desperately have to, make something of yourself at that point, you know, the junior and seniors are always considered the most, the years you draw on the most, like, that's, like, what you were in your junior and senior year. Because there's never really high school movies about the freshman and sophomore.
Freshman. You're right.
It's always the junior and senior years where there's the prom and all that, and the parties and all, everybody and the wild shit. It just, those last 2 years really just reminded me how this shit ain't going to go well. But, yeah, but that's just me. Like I said, antidepressants is working out well. But trying to keep this on an upbeat move. But I think we may, you know, have to. Well, first off, before we do, you were a features writer, and you told me you didn't like talking to people. Why?
Right.
I mean, how long were you a features writer? What stuff were you doing?
A year.
Yeah.
A whole year. And I did entertainment stories. I did food stories. I did I wrote weddings. I wrote up weddings because we still had weddings in the paper then. And, just general features. And I really did not like talking to people. I was too shy and I didn't ask the right questions and stuff. So I did okay. Like, one of my favorite stories I wrote during that time was about a young woman who was an actress or was a theater major at Lenore Ryan College, which is in Hickory, where I was working, and she was starring in The Crime of Miss Jean Brody. I remember this part so well. And I did a story about her to preview the play, you know, because that was one thing that we did.
Yeah.
And I remember just really enjoying talking to her, and I was very comfortable because she was younger than I was. You know, she was a college student, I was already out. And she was also very sweet and nice and everything. And I remember that being a really good experience. But most of the time when I was talking to people, I really I was too shy and I didn't really enjoy it that much. And I don't really, I'm not really made for that sort of thing, you know, for talking to, like right now, you know, talking to you is fine, but talk, if there were somebody else, I would be feeling kind of uncomfortable about it. Yeah.
Which is odd, because I always thought you were a jovial, outgoing type of person.
I am jovial, but I'm not outgoing, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm outgoing. My husband thinks I don't like people, and I sort of don't, but it's not really so much that I don't like people. I'm just worried that they won't like me, you know?
Well, if you give them treats, or if they'll enjoy you.
Candy and treats. That's the key to get people to like you. All right. Yeah. Yay. Now, I'll have to try that.
But you're like the fun, cute aunt. I find it very hard for anybody to look at you like, fuck that old lady, whoever that person is. No, they just look at you like, oh, she's probably going to pick up her nephews, and they're going to, I don't know, going to Art Splosure or something, and just...
Yeah! That's me. That really is me, though. You're right. Yeah. That's exactly who I am. And I think of you as like this tall fellow who is a massive in anxieties and worries on the inside, but who writes like a dream and has a bunch of information to convey to people, you know, that the people just listen to. And it's really cool. So anyway, so I wanted to ask you about your weight loss though. Are you dieting and exercise and stuff like that?
Yes, a combination of diet, exercise, and not eating.
Okay.
So I'm just, it's kind of been like that. And it's just basically something to do while I try and figure out what the hell is going to happen to me.
Yeah, still
for
a job? You're still looking for a full-time job?
Or? Yeah, it's nice. I'm still, it would be nice if I had a job and still had stuff going. Like I've been sending out for stuff like crazy and everything. So, but until then, I'm going to lose weight, so at least I'm not in pain most of the time. Which is crazy, because like I've been losing so much weight. Yeah, you know, it's just like, you know, the blood pressure goes up and down, and like a few weeks ago, my left leg kind of swelled up. And
oh yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of, cuz it like the, you know, cuz it was like uric acid kind of built up. It built up in my foot first, then it went up into my knee. And so I couldn't walk on that for a while, and I'd basically take a bunch of ibuprofen every day. So it was, I'm kind of coming down from that, and just, cause I've lost 70 pounds.
That's great.
Yeah, and so it's just, I've never lost that much weight in my life. So it's basically my body just trying to transition basically into this thing that I am now. And it's funny, and I've told people this, it's like, you can always tell, the great thing about losing weight is, of course, you know, you're healthier, you start to feel better, and you don't get, short-winded, is that it's an instant barometer on, who are the assholes in your life. because like when you immediately saw me on Skype here, you immediately acknowledge, Jesus, you're skinny, and just like, and we're on Skype, and so you just immediately saw that. I have bumped into many coworkers from the NNO, and they haven't said anything, and haven't noticed that I've literally shedded parts of me, and so it just like, and just like, oh, you know, you're an asshole, because you didn't. Because it just makes like, how can you not notice this? And just right. Like, and just like, you got to be like, maybe their minds are on something else or something. Maybe it's too much or too presumptuous to call them asses. But just like, it's just a thing where just like, hey, what have you been doing? Obviously, Pilates or something. Because I've lost a lot of weight. You don't see this, but they don't. Yeah. I guess they do. It was just.
Well, there are two things to look at that. There was one thing is that they might feel like, oh gosh, what if he's sick? You know, they might think, oh yeah, maybe it's too presumptuous of me to say something, you know, because I'm commenting on your looks, you know, or something like that. But yeah, they could acknowledge it. They could say, hey, you're looking good.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they don't even have to say anything more than that. Say,
yeah.
Hey, you're looking very good. You're looking very svelte these days.
Yeah.
Or something else.
But those are the people that I found that just didn't know exactly what to make of me, so they just
Well, there were a lot of people who didn't know you at the paper. I mean, they really didn't know who you were. They knew your name, but they didn't know who you were as a person. And I think they probably had assumptions about you that weren't true.
Yeah, and they were. At this sad part, they rather have those assumptions just there instead of just talking to me and just making sure if those assumptions were true or not. Because, well, I'm just going to believe this. So I won't have to deal with him. I'll just have this idea of who this dude is and not deal with.
Two kinds of people in the world. There are people who always assume the worst of people and people who always assume the best of people. You know what I mean? Even though I'm shy, I'm kind of shy and a little bit reclusive and everything, I pretty much figure that people are not bad, you know, and I assume that they're good people. And then they have to show me that they're not, you know, I don't assume that people are, and I think there are other people though who really do have just a very sour outlook on life and, you know, have a bad viewpoint of people. Maybe somebody just says one thing that kind of gets under their skin and they write that person off forever.
Yeah. It's funny because I was just thinking about that yesterday. Because there's this girl I know who, just had a baby. And, I remember, before she had the baby, she was at this bar I go to, and she's actually like one of the girlfriends of the bartender. And, I was trying to make a casual conversation. She was sitting at the end of the bar, looking at her laptop, looking at a website to buy a stroller. And I roll up to her and I just say, hey, I guess I'll ask a stupid question. Are you looking for a stroller? And then she went, no, I'm looking for an apartment. I'm just looking on this site for it. And I figured, oh, you're a douchebag. Not going to fuck with you anymore. Because it's just like, I just realized, it's like, listen, and you know, once again, you know me more, it's like I have this general attitude where it's just I have low expectations of everything. I wouldn't say I feel awful all the time, but it's in that range. So when somebody comes along and says something awful to me, it just, you know, I kind of take it, I get a little bit perturbed by it, and then it just seals in how I feel. And, you know, frankly, I'm willing to give that person the benefit of the doubt if that ever comes up, like, if I'm drunk and I just yell in her face, hey, what the fuck was up with that apartment lot and stuff like that? But you know, at the time being, you know, I often, you know, cause that's another thing. And we've been talking about this. Just, I'm one of those people. If I have a problem with you, I will come directly to you and try to talk this out. And I know, and I can see how people don't like confrontation. They don't have, they have problems with confrontation. They don't want to deal with people most of the time. But if you don't do that, there's gotta be a whole bunch of bullshit and things that just escalate and rise. And just like, it's much easier to just talk to people about things.
Yeah, and you're right.
And it's just like, I don't know why I feel I'm the only person who doesn't feel that embarrassed to do any of that.
I don't know either. Do you think that I mean, I do know because I grew up in a family where that was kind of, you didn't confront things, you know, maybe you grew up in a family where you did, where people were really open and honest and didn't let you get by with stuff. Like if you were doing something that annoyed your mother, she would tell you straight out, hey, stop doing that, right?
Yeah.
Was your mother like that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just.
So you grew up with your mother and your grandmother, right?
Yeah.
So was your grandmother there all the time too? Was she like that? Was she kind of straightforward and candid, or?
Yeah, straightforward, candid. It was a family full of people who didn't let anything get in the way of saying what they wanted to say. The sad part was not a lot of us listened to each other. We generally just didn't like each other much as people. So, so it was just us talking and yelling and because we're just trying to get our point across. And, I would try to talk to my grandmother about stuff. And she, I think, mastered this game that I call, oh, you think that's bad? Like, no matter what I said, she would turn around, you think that's bad? I can't walk on this foot anymore. And just like, so you couldn't, like, I have problems, Grandma. Can you just listen to my damn problems? So there's that. But, that was my experience growing up. But I was trying to see, if you wanted to, just talk about your family and, your times as a mother. Because, we know the things you've been through. But.
Right. I had a son, and he died, as you know. He died when he was not quite 21. He was a month away from his 21st birthday, and he died. And he was a great kid. He had Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum. And you know about autism, of course, because your brother had autism, right?
But
he was so smart. My son Jake was just brilliant and such an interesting person. And to me, he's the most interesting person I've ever met. And I would say that to anybody. He's more interesting than anybody. He was just, his mind worked in a way that I didn't really, that was fascinating, but I couldn't really. My mind didn't work that way, you know. He would be very logical about things and everything. So, and that was really important to me. And it was really, and it's been 3.5 years, a little bit more than 3.5 years, since he died. And it's been, my husband wrote something to a friend of his on Facebook that it was just really, it's like things just aren't right, you know. Mm. You know, things just aren't right without Jake here. So, even though our life goes on, we have to go on. You know, I mean, I have a husband. I need to help. I need to be here for him, and I need to be there for my parents because they're old and sometimes they need my help. And I need to keep going for that, and I need to keep a job so that I can contribute to society and all that. But it's just not right.
Yeah.
You know, without my son here, it's just not right. My life was never as good as it was when he was alive. So, but anyway, we one of the things that we did that I try to do anyway is to look at pictures of him and to do things that he liked to do. Like, it's a really goofy thing, but he really liked the movie George of the Jungle, you know, that had Brendan Fraser and Leslie Mann. And it was on television yesterday while I was on the treadmill. I was walking on the treadmill. So I watched it again. It just thrilled me so much because I really liked that movie too. But what thrilled me is remembering watching it with Jake and how funny he thought it was. And so doing the things, I put his music from his iTunes library on my iPod because he really liked the Beatles and the Who. And a lot of monkeys, really, you know, things that were done years before he was born. But he also liked Nirvana and Weird Al Yankovic. And so I listened to his songs, and it, So I try to remember him, remember the things he did, but the thing that's really hard is that I think, okay, it's been 3.5 years, he would have changed, you know? Yeah. How would he have changed? What would Jake be like now? And it just, and I wonder about it so much. I wonder where he would be. Would he have graduated from college? Would he have, gotten a job? And I'm almost sure he'd still be living at home, but that would be okay. I would love that actually, but eventually he would have gotten out and gotten his own place because that's what he always wanted to, That was one of his, he had a friend. He thought, PJ and I can get a place together. That would be great. So I try to think about that,
Yeah.
So it's when you are a mom and then you sort of stop being a mom because your child died, you do lose a little bit of your identity there, you lose a little bit of something that you were. And so in some ways, that's one of the reasons I wanted to just keep being a copy editor for the News Observer. It's because I'd already lost the thing that was the very most important thing to me. I didn't want to lose something else that was part of my identity. So anyway, I don't know what I would tell people who, I think about it because I see other people going through the pain of losing people they love, and everybody goes through it differently. Everybody has a different sense of loss, Like losing a child is different from losing a parent, but even my losing my child is different from somebody else losing their child, because the circumstances or whatever is different, And in Jake's case, it was just so unexpected and so completely unexpected, even though he was in the hospital and he had surgery. It wasn't, it was the kind of surgery people come through all the time. People don't, that kind of thing doesn't, the people dying from complications of surgery, that doesn't usually happen to a 20-year-old. That happens to, 80-year-olds or babies. It doesn't usually happen to a relatively healthy young man.
But was it just something that happened internally, or was there like some fault in the people?
The doctor made a mistake at some point. He got an infection that it didn't show up because he didn't have a fever or anything like that, but he just didn't feel right. And there was a mistake made at some point in his surgery, but nobody detected it. Nobody understood that there had been a problem. So that's what we had an autopsy done after he died because it was just so, at first we thought it was, like a blood clot or something like that, but that wasn't it. It was an infection that came from the surgery. And, anyway, that was what happened there.
I mean, was there any talk of legal action or anything?
We did talk to a lawyer about it, but the lawyers didn't see that there was a case there. And, part of that is that, Jake was a young man who didn't, if he had been a father, who had dependent children, or if he were the support of his, of something like that, then there might have been a way to say that there's more, but also they said that the doctor, it was that mistakes happen, but that the doctor didn't make a mistake afterwards, or not a mistake that they could prove in court anyway. And to me, the only reason that I would want anyone to you know, that I would have wanted to go through with that was if there was something I thought was systematically wrong, you know, that either with the care he got at the hospital or the care he got from his doctors. And I couldn't really see that there was anything systematically wrong. I think that was just an instance that it was a terrible, I don't want to say accident exactly, but just a confluence of circumstances that wouldn't necessarily ever happen again, you know?
Yeah.
I think. And then part of it was, too, is that just, you know, you don't want to live it over and over again, you know?
Yeah.
Do you have that feeling about your brother? Do you have that feeling? Because, to me, it always seemed like the people who should have been taking care of him didn't take as good care of him as they should have, you know?
Well, since you talk about the lawyer saying that, you know, it would have been, you would have had a case if your son was a father or something, because that was kind of one of the, I talked to several lawyers, you know, when he was missing, and then when they later found his remains in, you know, one lawyer said that, first of all, I didn't have a case because I'm the brother. If I was
right.
If I was the spouse, if I was the parent, that would have had something. But I'm just the brother, so I can't even say anything. So that kind of put a nip in the bud. They're like, yeah, I talked to several lawyers, and they all had reasons why I didn't really have any case. So yeah, that was an unfortunate thing that happened. And so I know. A lot of people I know tell me, you know, maybe, you know, it has have felt more upset about it, you know, seems than I have. You know, I've lived it for so long now, but it's just like, it is just, you know, and just one of the many things, as I said, just like it just makes, just doesn't necessarily, yeah, about my life in general, how just like my mother died of cancer in 2005. My grandmother, who basically mostly raised me, she died 3 months before my mother died. And when I was in Houston trying to, when I came to, you know, before she died, and everything, trying. I spent 4 months trying to figure out what I was going to do with my brother and see how, you know, put him in a proper facility. And then, you know, then they hit me up on Facebook saying that he's missing. And then that was, three, four years or something. Then finally they called me a forensic expert called me last year and said that they found his skull in a ditch and everything. So it's just like, yeah, it's one of those things where you just left numb, because it's like this is like, and tell you the truth, is I've kind of prepared myself for the worst at any given moment, and it's just you do feel it's just there's just emptiness, and because half my family's dead and my other half, I barely know where the hell they are. They could be in jail. They could be in some. I don't know where they are. So I'm just this nomad out here. I have nothing. Like, the holidays blow for me. Like, just,
yeah.
Just wandering around. Everybody's joyous and everything. I don't have anything except this time when I talk to friends for a podcast. Just trying to get some sort of connection. That's why I realized why I was so mad at the lady about the stroller and the apartment thing. But just like, I wasn't trying to do anything except make a connection with you, and you thought about I was trying to pick you up or do something, or you know, try to drunkenly hit on you or whatever. I was just trying to talk to you. I wasn't trying to do anything else. Yeah, and it's funny. I've gotten a point now in my life where just like it's nice to talk to people because, hey, just like you never know when you might need stuff or whatever, or just this is like you need just, you know, some company or just whether it be company or a ride to the airport, or just to know that there's somebody out there that cares for you somewhat. Yeah, just
right.
When you're just all alone out here, and as somebody who experiences firsthand, I mean, my mother didn't tell anybody she had cancer. She literally kept that to herself. Nobody knew. And so, and because she was that intensely private a person,
uh-huh.
that she didn't want any, like, hospice people had to tell me that she had cancer, and it was just like rip. And frankly, I knew that something was going on. I mean, the last time before I saw her, you know, she was skinny. She was skinny, more skinnier than I was. And I was like, uh-huh. and I remember telling her point blank, "Are you dying? What's going on?" And she was denying it and everything. So,
really? She even when you asked her about it, she wouldn't tell you?
No.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So because I remember telling somebody, you know, I was telling somebody, and she was like, maybe she couldn't believe it herself. She could not get herself to get to that point where she had to admit that she was dying, or even that she had cancer, and so you know, when you're that far gone where you it's sad thing, because like my family's always had this sense that we needed each other, but we wouldn't admit it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So yeah, and so we reluctantly relied on each other. And it was just like this sad thing. It's like, motherfucker, we're family. We're in this together, and this is how you all gonna act and everything. It was just so sad. So like now it's down to the point where I'm just like, listen, I don't have much in the family department. So I'm just gonna try to make as much, connections with people as possible, and just try to be out there so I don't feel like I'm just all alone in this universe,
uh-huh.
where it just all comes down to it. And just, and I know it sounds kind of, you know, odd, new agey or whatever, just trying to find some semblance of just communicating with people and not make it. I know I can look menacing. I've been walking around these past few weeks talking like I'm wondering if the reason why I'm so unlucky with women is because I look rapisty. And so, but you know, just basically trying to, you know, get people to say hello to me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah. And I mean, just in the 3.5 years, I mean, as you said, you've been trying just to make sure that, you know, your memories of Jake are not lost, and just, I mean, is anything else that you've learned or gathered, you know, from this time? Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing is that I thought about just this morning about how I don't like to waste time,
uh-huh.
you know, as much. I mean, I like to waste it on things that I want to waste on, but I don't like other people to waste my time for me. You know, I'm a lot more like people who just won't get to the point, or people who are just, you just waste your time. Or just sitting, like waiting for a table at a restaurant. We waited an hour and a half for a table at a restaurant recently, and I'm thinking, I don't want to do that anymore. We went to Merle Fest, to the music festival.
Yeah.
And the headline band was Charlie Daniels Band, Puke. And then another headline band was Government Mule.
Yeah.
With Warren Haynes. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, well, I'm not wasting my time anymore with that. You know, I don't care. You know, the next time I pay money to see music, it's going to have to be something I really want to see. You know, I'm not going to waste my time on old has-been rock and roll bands or old has-been country music bands. But anyway, part of that is just realizing that life is short, and that, you know, you don't have forever, and that I don't want to waste my time doing things that I think are not, you know, that are not fun, or that are not worthwhile, or not what I want to do. I mean, I may waste time doing what I want to do, but I don't want other people to waste it for me. Anyway, that's something that I don't know whether that's come from losing Jake, or if that comes from almost from being a year away from 60. I don't know, but it could be both. But the other thing is too, is that when you do have a child, when your child is little, you know, be there, mm-hmm. be with that child,
yeah.
and be in the moment and really try to understand him or her and try to really accept the child as he really is. From, you know, and it took me a while, and that was a really, you know, when you have a child who has what's called a disorder, sometimes I think Jake's Asperger's was actually a really blessing, but that you go through this kind of grieving thing, you know, where you don't have the child you wanted to have, maybe.
Yeah.
But I had exactly the child I should have had. I had exactly the child I wanted, and I just needed to accept him the way it was. And it took me a while to do that, but I think I did eventually. And I would tell parents to do that, you know, accept your child the way he is and, or she is, and let them be, you know, let them be whoever they are. Don't try to, I mean, you have to teach them to be good people. You have to teach them to be polite and to not be criminals and stuff. But, you know, but other than that, you need to let them be who they are, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that was something that I hope I learned before Jake died, but I know I've learned since then. It's been reinforced and stuff. But the other good thing is, you were talking about family and not having family, and that was one of the good things that happened to Chris and me after Jake died, is that our family did come together for us. And that was, you know, my sister and my brothers and Chris's brothers and sister, you know, closed ranks around us and helped us get through it. And they've helped us, and they continue to help us to get through it, you know, by being there. So that was important. And my parents were, Chris's father wasn't all that helpful, but, you know, but his family's kind of, his parents had kind of a dysfunctional thing going on, but we were lucky that we did have people who came together to help us. So yeah, I hope that you can create a way of, you know, a way of creating your own family, even if it's from, you know, spare parts or whatever, you know, to find somebody who will accept you the way you are and understand you the way you are. That's a big thing, you know,
yeah.
Understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. Just
accepting.
Understanding, accepting is what we, a lot of people need more of these days. I can end it.
Yeah.
If I can end this podcast on an even cornier note, if that didn't sound, you know, I don't know, I'll Jerry Lewis telethon-ish or something. But, Pam, this is usually the part of the podcast where I ask people, they're online, if they're on Twitter, if they got, where can people find you, if you have a Pinterest page?
Okay. I have a blog. It's at I can't remember my own blog address. I have to look at it. And I'm also on Twitter at Grammar Guide, which is Grammar Guide at Twitter. And my blog is grammarguide.copydesk.org.
Uh-huh.
And I'm on Facebook. I have both the Pam Nelson person, and then I also have a Grammar Guide Facebook page too.
Oh,
that's pretty much where I am.
Yeah. And so, how was this for you, dear?
This was good.
Yeah, just.
I'm really glad to catch up with you. It's been a while.
I'm really glad to catch up with you, and just like you've always been there, and you're just a very wonderful person, and just and all of that. It's hard for me to be affectionate towards people since I don't really know how to do that,
yeah.
Really. But just, you know, I've always enjoyed just being around you and just enjoyed everything you do that you brought to me and to everybody. So just I wish you nothing but the best in your future endeavors. And I know your 60th is going to be a rager.
Okay.
So
we'll see.
enjoy. So thank you for letting me do this. Thanks for talking, and just let me close this out here as always. This is Craig D. Lindsay saying, yeah, this 1997. Let's just leave it at that. All right.